Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd suffer the embarrassment of hemibolismus if you shook me up with the idea that you missed today's show. Doing Good Better. William McCaskill is the author of Doing Good Better, a book that introduces effective altruism for individuals. There are worthy takeaways for your nonprofit as we discuss how your donors can give smarter to make the greatest difference. That originally aired August 14th, 2015. On Tony's Take 2, jumpstart your planned giving. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. You'll raise more money. Pursuant.com. And by We Be Spelling, super cool spelling bee fundraisers. WeBeeSpelling.com. Here is William McCaskill and Doing Good Better. It's time to welcome my guest, William McCaskill, associate professor in philosophy at Oxford University and co-founder of the nonprofit organizations Giving What We Can and 80,000 Hours. They've raised over $400 million in lifetime pledged donations to charities and helped spark the effective altruism movement, which we'll be talking a lot about. You may have heard about Will and his organizations in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, National Public Radio, and TED Talks. He lives in Oxford, England, but he's calling from somewhere on the West Coast, I'm not sure where, to talk about his new book, Doing Good Better, How Effective Altruism Can Help You Make a Difference, published just in April by Gotham Books, an imprint of Penguin Random House. He's at Will McCaskill on Twitter. Will McCaskill, welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio.
It's great to speak to you.
It's a pleasure. Where are you calling from?
Calling from Mountain View, just outside of San Francisco.
Okay, cool. Is it beautiful there in Mountain View today?
It's beautiful every day in Mountain View.
Every day
compared to Oxford,
right? As opposed to Oxford, which is probably not beautiful every day.
No, it's pretty gray and rainy most days.
Yeah.
Quite a pleasant experience being in the California summer.
I love it. Wonderful. Welcome. Effective altruism. You're working at the intersection of economics, psychology, and philosophy. What is this about?
Effective altruism is about using your time and money as effectively as possible to make the world a better place. That means taking a scientific approach, using high-quality evidence, good data, and careful logical reasoning in order to ensure that when you give to charity or when you choose a career that you're aiming to use to make a difference, you're using it to not just make a difference, but to make the most difference you can.
The biggest possible difference.
That's right.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of economic theory wrapped up in this. Effective altruism is, and the book is, devoted to individuals and their giving, right?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. But we're going to draw a lot of lessons for nonprofits because there are valuable lessons there in what you're recommending for individuals. I love stories. So could we, and you introduce the theory of effective altruism with a deworming story in Kenya. Can you share that, please?
Sure. So in the 1990s, Michael Kramer, who was a development economist at Harvard, he was working in Kenya, and he was working with a charity called ICS that did a variety of education programs for the poor in that country. And he was working with them, and he just had the obvious question, which was, well, have you actually tested this to see if it works, to see how effective it was? And the answer was that they hadn't. And in fact, at the time, basically no one had been doing high-quality experiments to test different development programs. And so what they did was they started investigating all the different things that this charity was doing. And the results were really interesting. So they'd take something that seemed very obviously like it would have a big impact, distributing textbooks, for example, to schools where they'd only have one textbook per classroom. And they'd distribute the textbooks in 7 schools, then they'd just monitor 7 other schools where they wouldn't do any intervention in order to compare what the difference was. And they actually found there was just no effect.
Yeah.
Distributing textbooks just didn't improve outcomes.
It's totally right,
educationally speaking.
Well, it's totally counterintuitive. We would all think that students with more textbooks are going to learn better, have better education outcomes, because they don't have to share one textbook for 20 children the way it often is. It's just so intuitive.
Completely counterintuitive. Yeah. So the things that we think obviously this would be really effective often end up having no impact, can even have negative impact, can be harmful.
Yeah.
And then other things which we would not even know about or think of as very boring or underwhelming can be extraordinarily effective. So, for example, what they ended up testing. So they tested textbooks, flip charts. All these just had no effect. And then they ended up testing deworming school children. So over 1 billion people worldwide suffer from intestinal worms. And they can be cured very cheaply for less than $1 per child. And so they tried rolling out mass deworming programs to a number of schools. And they found an extraordinary effect on increasing school attendance. It was really quite remarkable. And when it was followed up with later on, it was found that the children who'd been dewormed had improved earnings and were able to work more hours as well. So this very boring, extremely unsexy program ended up having this extraordinary impact in terms of improvements to the lives of the poor in Kenya.
Love it. Yeah. It's not something we would think of. It takes a development specialist. And I think you make it clear that he just was talking to a friend who worked for the World Bank or one of the development programs. And that person suggested deworming, and it led to the results that that you described. But I get a physical chill when listening to you tell the story, just like I did when I was reading it. Yes, intuition leads us astray so much. And if we really want to make the most effective, biggest change possible, we have to be more analytical, a little more cold-hearted, considerably more cold-hearted than we are about our giving decisions.
That's right. I think, we take this approach when we buy products. So, if you wouldn't just normally buy a product that someone just comes up to you in the street and pitches you on. You'd want to really if you were buying a laptop, you'd want to look into it. You'd want to ensure that you were getting, you might look at reviews online. You'd want to ensure that you were buying the best laptop you can for the given price. And I'm just saying we should take a similar sort of approach when we're giving to charity. We should be trying to look at not just does this charity have glossy leaflets with smiling children, but actually if I give a certain amount of money, what's the outcome of that going to be? And how can I spend my money such that, I can get the best value with my donation?
Yep, brilliant. Okay. And you devote the first half of the book to a series of 5 questions. We have just about 2 minutes before our first break, but of course we're together for the hour, so not to worry. Why don't you introduce the first question and just talk a little about it in roughly a minute and a half or so.
Okay. So the first question is, how many people benefit and by how much? So this is the thought that when you're going to do any sort of activity, whether that's activity of your nonprofit or donating or volunteering, the impact you have should be cashed out in terms of impact on people's well-being. And that means if you can benefit more people or if you can benefit the same number of people by a greater amount, then that's better to do. And that's just crucial. We need to look at the outcomes that actually a program has, rather than say when looking at a charity, how much is the CEO paid or what are the overhead costs. They aren't actually that important, because what we should care about ultimately is just how is this money that we're giving turning into improved improvements in terms of people's quality of life.
Okay, let's go out for that break now. We'll take care of this. When we come back, Will and I are going to talk about the rest of the questions, of course, and continue with this one. How many people benefit and by how much? We'll talk about quali. What's a quali? You're going to learn. And what was going on in triaging at a Red Cross hospital in Rwanda in 1994? Stay with us.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at TonyMartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Let's do a little bit of live listener love. Let's start domestic, because we've got, of course, we've got the listeners abroad. But let's start with St. Louis, Missouri, New York, New York. Oh, thank you, New York City. Thanks for being here. And Hubert, North Carolina. Of course, I got my place in North Carolina. Live listener love. There's more coming. Of course, podcast pleasantries always go out to those listening wherever, whatever, whether you're washing dishes or driving a taxi. Podcast pleasantries to those listening, doing all those things and other things. And, of course, affiliate affections to our many affiliate AM and FM stations across the country. Affections to those affiliate listeners. Never forget them. We got listeners in all different channels, all different categories. Multi-channel nonprofit radio. Will, let's... Again, I love stories. This is such a wrenching one. But that brings to light this first question of how many people benefit and by how much. What was James Orbinski up to? Just a little briefly in Rwanda, 1994.
Yeah. So James Orbinski was working for Doctors Without Borders in Rwanda in 1994 during the genocide, and he was one of the only nonprofit workers still there when the genocide was happening. And the story I tell was of a particularly harrowing day for him. He was manning a tiny hospital, and there was just a huge number of casualties coming in, far more than he could treat. And the level of the severity of the casualties were very extreme indeed. And that meant that he had to do as any good doctor does and engage in triage. And because the conditions were so extreme, he had to assign each person coming in a number that actually just got taped to their forehead. So one meant treat immediately, two meant wait and try and, it's not as urgent, try and treat within the first 24 hours, and three meant irretrievable, and the best they could do was provide morphine and blankets so they could pass away in comfort. And this is obviously an absolutely harrowing situation to be in, but it illustrates the importance of and the necessity of making hard trade-offs. So if James Orbinski had simply thrown up his hands and said, well, I'm just going to treat whoever's first in front of me, or I'm going to treat people randomly, that would have been a much worse outcome. He would have saved far fewer lives, he would have helped far fewer people. And we might think, oh, it's so lucky that we're not in situations like this. But in a very real sense, our situation is similar. Whenever we're trying to do good, whenever we're trying to give to charity or volunteer our time, we're making decisions about who we help and who we don't. And especially when it comes to charity that could benefit the poorest people in the world, these things literally are life and death for someone. And that means we can't just say, okay, I'll just give to whatever I happen to have heard about or whatever's salient to me. We do need to go through this process of hard trade-offs and thinking, how can I benefit people by as much as possible? Accepting that means we're going to help some people and not help others.
Qually, Q-A-L-Y, Q-A-L-Y. What is a qually?
So a qually, it's a little bit of technical terminology I use in my book, and it's a metric used by health economists in order to assess the size of an impact of a health program. So what QALY stands for is Quality Adjusted Life Year. The idea is that there's two ways by which you can give someone a health benefit. Firstly, you can extend someone's life, so you can make someone live longer than they would otherwise have lived, and extending their life by more rather than less is normally better. Or secondly, you can improve someone's quality of life while they're still alive. So curing someone of migraines won't extend their life, but it will make their quality of life better while they're alive. And the quality-adjusted life year takes into account both of these ways of benefiting someone and enables us to make comparisons across all different sorts of health programs so that you can work out which have the greatest benefit for the given amount of money.
You mentioned migraines. You're a migraine sufferer yourself, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I know. I learned from reading the book, I know you have migraines and back pain.
Yeah, I know. And they were very salient to me as I was trying to write to deadlines, and then they would interfere.
Anything else going on that we should know about? Are you okay today?
I'm doing pretty well today, actually.
Okay, very good.
The back pain's been a lot better recently.
Okay. Now, typically on nonprofit radio, we have jargon jail, but you did not transgress because you quickly defined, and I'm the one who introduced QALY, so you're not a scofflaw subject to jargon jail, so not to worry.
I'm happy about that.
In case that was causing you concern, yes. There are guests who come on with a great deal of anxiety about jargon jail, but you needn't worry, at least not about QALY. So we can use this.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. We can use this measure to evaluate and rank the success and the effectiveness, the outcomes of different charities in the health related missions.
That's exactly right. So the idea is, if you cure someone of sight, that would be moving. So they use survey data to find out how bad different sorts of conditions are, and people who are blind rate their kind of quality of life at 50% compared to being fully sighted. And so if you can cure someone of blindness for 2 years, that would be moving them from 50% to 100% health, quality of life, for 2 years, which would equal one quality-adjusted life year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think the take-home for nonprofits around this first question of the five is that you want to be sharing how you are improving lives, and you want to show those metrics if that's your work.
That's right. And also, if you're choosing between different programs, then it's not enough to look at, you know, how much does this cost per bed net? How much does am I spending per deworming tablet or person served? You actually want to try and go that extra step and say, okay, for all these things, how is that actually translating into people's well-being? And if there are some programs that I'm doing that are helping far fewer people or helping them by much less of an extent, then you should probably be deprioritizing those and focusing on the ones that really do have the biggest impact.
So it's these intermediate measures, like distributing books or, you say, you know, the nets that we shouldn't be paying attention to. It's the, well, variously called, I hear it, either the outcome or the impact of that middle activity.
That's exactly right. And it's particularly important because some of these intermediate metrics, like distributing textbooks, as you say, actually don't have any improvements, at least in some contexts, in terms of people's well-being.
Okay. All right. Let's go to our second question, which is this the most effective thing that you can do? Please flesh that out a little.
So the idea behind this question is that different social programs vary massively in how impactful they are. And in fact, most social programs, when tested, seem to have no impact at all. But even among those that do, and even among those that are, in fact, very good in terms of the impact they have, you can still do far, far more good if you choose to focus on the very best programs. And that means that when we're thinking about doing good, it's not enough to just think, okay, I want to make a difference, this thing has an impact, therefore it's a good thing to do. But we need to ask, is this the most difference that I'm making? And you know, I give examples such as within developing world education, providing free school uniforms has a significant effect on improving educational outcomes, school attendance for children in sub-Saharan Africa.
Why is that?
You might think. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, why is that? What's that connection between school uniforms and improved performance?
Yeah, so in many countries, it's just a requirement that the child has to have a school uniform if they're to attend school. And you might think, you know, that's a silly policy, but it does exist in some countries. And that means that for some families, they just can't afford the school uniforms. And for that somewhat trivial-seeming reason, they can't send their children to school.
Oh, my.
And so
yes.
By providing a school uniform for free, you enable the family to send the child to school.
Remarkable. Yeah. Give us another... Can you cite another example? I love these.
Of improving school attendance.
It could be, but it doesn't have to be. Another example, yes, from the most effective method.
Yeah, so another example, I mean, so within healthcare and global health, it's the easiest to see. So there are many activities you can do that will save lives for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars, like providing antiretrovirals to treat HIV, for example. But the most amazing example is the eradication of smallpox, has so far saved over 60 million lives since it was eradicated in 1973. That's actually more lives than would have been saved if we'd prevented all wars, all political famines, all genocides, and all terrorist acts in that time.
Mm, that's incredible.
So in terms of the death toll, the eradication of smallpox was better than world peace. And it only cost $1.4 billion in the money of the time, which means the cost per life saved was about as low as $12. So that's just an extraordinary example of incredible impact. And even though spending, you know, $10,000 or $100,000 to save a life is an incredibly good use of money, examples like smallpox show that the very best uses of money are just, you know, even better again. And we still have opportunities that are almost as good as that by distributing long-lasting insecticide-treated bed nets to protect children from malaria, such as through the Against Malaria Foundation. There you can save a life for about $3,500, statistically speaking. And that's, again, just this absolutely huge impact and, you know, far, far better even than merely very good ways of making a difference.
Right, you say, yeah, you do that in the book a few times. Merely very good. But
Exactly, and it's a big difference between that and the best.
Right, right. And I have to just repeat something you said, that the eradication of smallpox was a larger lifesaver than world peace.
Yeah, than world peace would have been.
Would have been, right, right. This is startling.
And in fact, in the whole 20th century, even when you include World War I and World War II, smallpox killed more people before it was eradicated than all war.
Mm. Damn. It's so moving. Especially, I mean, we're just, this month was the anniversary of the two nuclear bombs dropped in Japan, for God's sake. And all those lives, still more than all those lives and all the others in all the world wars. Yeah. All right. So there's a lesson here for nonprofits, in terms of where they're going to focus their time and precious money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really means, I think intuitively we'd think if something's very good. So again, this is thinking about what programs you might pursue. And charities often pursue a variety of different programs like Oxfam or UNICEF or CARE, you know, a whole big distribution. But it's probably the case that some of these programs do way more good than others. So in business, you might have heard of the 80-20 rule, where 80% of the value comes from 20% of the effort. But the same thing applies in charity or in doing good as well. It's just often a small number of the programs that are doing far, far more in terms of impact than many others. And that's why it's crucial to then find out what those are and really scale those up.
and de-emphasize those that that are not, that just don't yeah, measure, exactly. that don't measure up. Yeah. Now we've been talking a lot about health and poverty. Where do cultural organizations fit into this this methodology? Art and history museums, theaters. How do they fit this scheme?
Yeah. So ultimately, I think it's going to be hard to justify donating to art and history museums when the comparison is that you could be donating to saving lives in very poor countries. And I mean, the way you measure it is in terms of, again, how many people benefit and by how much. So you're spending a certain amount running a museum. How many people are being affected by this? So obviously attending museums is a life enriching experience. You could ask, well, by how much is it enriching people's lives and how many people are coming through every year? And then, so that's one thing. Then there's a second thing that you might think is just a kind of reason to do charity that's outside this framework. So the book concerns altruism, which is about helping people as much as possible. You might think it's just intrinsically very important to preserve great works of art or preserve historical artifacts. And that might be right, but again, I think, we should think about the trade-offs we have to make. So if you're funding or if you're spending your time on a museum, how valuable is it to preserve this work of art, where that's cashed out in terms of the loss of the opportunity to be saving other people's lives? And I think as soon as you put the decision, in terms of that trade-off, which is the decision we face, then I think it becomes quite a bit harder to justify, spending philanthropic money on things like museums rather than life-saving interventions in poor countries.
Mm. All right, we have to take a break. Will is going to stay with us, of course, for the second half. More of Doing Good Better is coming up. First, Pursuant. Another free webinar coming up. This one is Breakthrough Fundraising. If you want to break through, then you need to identify your current perceptions and how they impact your current actions. Then you get insight into what would otherwise be invisible obstacles that are holding you back. Lots of valuable introspection, or you might think it's a load of crap. If you see the value, then register at pursuant.com, click resources, and then webinars. It's called Breakthrough Fundraising. We Be Spelling, Spelling Bees for Fundraising. They put on a live game show for your audience. It's part spelling bee, part concert, part stand-up comedy show, and all for your fundraising. Their video shows you what went on at one of their parties. It's at webeespelling.com. Now, Tony's Take Two. Pursuant isn't the only place on this show where you get a free webinar. I've got one coming up. That's me, Tony. Let's talk about me for a change, please. It's Jumpstart Your Planned Giving. If you don't have a planned giving program in your fundraising mix, I'm talking to you. We're going to cover how to start. It's very easy. Where to start? I know, because I've been starting planned giving programs for 14 years as a consultant and 6 years before that as a frontline fundraiser. And lots of tips on 5-minute marketing for your planned giving program. It's on March 16th at 2 o'clock Eastern. Register at tony.me/jumpstartyourpg. tony.me/jumpstartyourpg. And my video introducing it is at tonymartinetti.com. That is Tony's Take Two. Here's more with William McCaskill. Will McCaskill, the associate professor in philosophy at Oxford University, of course, still with us. Will, let's do you feel like we've done justice for question number two? Is this the most effective thing you can do?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Then go ahead, introduce the third question, please.
So the third question is this area neglected? And I think that's crucial because things in general have diminishing returns. If you have one coffee, that makes you feel great, you really enjoy it. By the fourth or fifth, then you're feeling kind of sick. And that's just true for social programs as well. We can normally, and this comes out in two ways. One is it means that you can do the most to benefit people who are the very poorest, because the lowest hanging fruit in terms of things that improve people's lives have not yet been taken. And that's in fact crucial because the scale of global inequality is just so great. So it's actually almost unimaginably great, where the poorest billion people in the world live on less than $1.50. And what that means is per day. And when what that $1.50 per day means is what $1.50 could buy in the U.S., which, if you think about it, is a bag of rice or something. So it's, it's already taken into account the fact that money goes further overseas. And that means that, in general, if you want to improve people's lives, focusing on the poorest people is, you know, often the most effective thing to do. And then the second aspect is focusing on neglected causes, where if a certain cause area already gets a huge amount of funding, then it's just going to be very hard for your additional donations or additional effort to have as much of an impact. And an example I give is talking about disaster relief.
Yes.
Where natural disasters, because they're so salient, because they get so much publicity, they receive much more in funding per casualty than what I would call ongoing natural disasters, like tuberculosis, malaria, neglected tropical diseases, HIV, AIDS. These are killing far more people every single day than natural disasters do, but get a lot less attention and therefore get less funding. And that means that you can do more good by donating to these ongoing problems than you can by donating to natural disaster relief.
And that marginal dollar that you contribute does so much less around natural disaster relief than it can elsewhere in these, what you call the ongoing natural disasters. That's the diminishing returns.
Yeah, that's right. And that's not to say that we shouldn't have disaster relief. We certainly should. It's very important that it gets funded. The question is just, given how everyone else is acting, what's the additional benefit of my action?
Yes, that incremental. And that's it's equivalent to the kinds of questions that James Orbinski was asking in Rwanda. I mean, what is the most effective thing that I can do? Where is my time and his expertise as a doctor best spent to be most effective?
Yeah, that's
and right. and not dealing with the as you said, you know, as the cases came in, but we think that way. We see on CNN the disaster videos, and all of a sudden there's a text to give campaign, and it's so easy to do. It's just dropped in our lap, but that's not the best decision making.
Yeah, I think so. I think this actually almost provides an argument explicitly against donating or working on causes that you feel kind of intuitively very emotionally compelled towards, because it's probably the case that those are the things that are most salient to you that many other people are also finding intuitively compelled towards, and so are very heavily funded. So I think this is true for example, poverty in the United States, or homelessness, or poor education in the United States. These are very salient. Obviously, these are big problems, but they're very salient problems to many people in the U.S., and that means they get much more attention than problems that are much less salient to us, even though they're even more extreme, like extreme poverty, like terrible lack of education, basic health problems in poor countries.
Lesson here for nonprofits, I think, again, around program choice, but also career choice. Why don't you around whether this is a neglected cause? Why don't you let's talk on the individual level a little around career choice.
Yeah, so I talk a bit about a guy called Greg Lewis, who became a doctor because he wanted to help people. And it was in the course of being a doctor, he was also a very good statistician. He started to wonder, well, how much good does a doctor actually do? You know, how much of an impact am I really making in the world? And you think it might be obvious. So if you're a surgeon, then maybe you're performing life-saving surgeries every day. But the insight Greg had was, if he wasn't that surgeon, then someone else would do the same work in his place. And in particular, him becoming a doctor, it's not like he's the average doctor. In the US, there's 850,000 physicians. By becoming an extra doctor, he'd be just the 850,001st doctor.
Yes.
So, and when, you know, as a kind of healthcare system as a whole, you're going to treat the most important illnesses and ailments first. So that the impact of an additional doctor is just on treating kind of more minor conditions. And he incorporated that analysis and ended up working out that he was doing an equivalent amount of good, measured in terms of quality-adjusted life years again, or QALYs, that was equivalent to about saving 2 or 3 lives. So far, far less than he was actually, than you would have thought intuitively.
Yes.
And that's because, as a doctor in a rich country like the US or UK, all the most effective health programs and interventions are going to be performed whatever you do. Whereas in a very poor country, then that's not nearly as likely to be the case. And so again, you could have a bigger impact there. There's a second aspect though as well. So Greg actually ended up not pursuing medicine. I mean, not pursuing, not going to Africa or another poor country or some poor country in order to work there. But instead, stayed working in the UK in order to do good through his donations instead. And that's relevant because it's a path not many people do. Again, is this neglected coming in? And it means he could target his donations to the very most effective charities. And it's a path that I call earning to give, trying to do good, not just through your direct labor, but through your ability to donate.
Yes. Choosing a career path that enables you to donate and target versus choosing a career path in the nonprofit NGO sector.
That's exactly right.
All right.
And I think often you can, you know, you're able to pay for several charity workers with your donations, depending on the sorts of opportunities you have available to you.
You make the point, I think, very eye-opening, that the average reader of this, and certainly everybody in the U.S., is the 1% that we have come to revile through the campaign, you know, the campaign against the 1% that started really here in the city. Make that point for us about all of us being the 1%.
Yeah, so normally when people use the 1%, they're referring to domestic inequality. They're referring to people who earn above about $350,000 per year. And domestic inequality is very extreme, and I'd like to see countries like the UK and US have a much more equal distribution of wealth than
income. Yeah.
But it just pales in comparison to the scale of global inequality. And in fact, to be in the richest 1% worldwide, then you only need to be earning about $50,000 as an individual post-tax. And certainly everyone in the U.S. is at least in the richest 15% of the world's population. So even people that we think of as very poor, living on the poverty line in the United States, are still in the richest 15% of the world.
Yes.
And again, all these figures are already taking into account the fact that money goes much further overseas. What's called purchasing power parity adjusted, and I'm worried I'm going to go to jargon jail for that.
Yeah, you will. Okay. Explain it, but I think you did. It's already adjusted for the difference of cost of living across different countries.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And so what this means, I mean, I think it's easy to see these figures and feel saddened or distraught, but I actually think we should flip it around and think, well, actually, we have this amazing opportunity. So by luck of being born into a rich country or being able to move to a rich country, we're among the richest people in the world. And that means we have an incredible power to do good just by transferring in a wise, effective way some of our resources to the poorest people in the world. And using some of the literature from happiness economics, I give estimates about just how big an impact should we expect that to be. And I call it the hundredfold multiplier. So even if all you were doing was literally just making yourself poorer by $1 and making one of the very poorest people in the world richer by $1, you would be having that money would have 100 times the impact in terms of people's well-being. And so it's this extraordinary opportunity we have.
Startling. Yeah. Yeah. I love, okay, thank you for explaining. That was a very uplifting comment and or explanation, and I overstated it. It's not everyone in the U.S. is in the 1%, but even those at poverty level in the U.S. are in the richest 15%, as you said. Thank you. It's very startling. We just have, again, about 2 minutes before a break. Question number four is, what would happen otherwise? What's going on here?
Yeah, so here the crucial issue is the difference you make is the difference between the good you do and what would have happened even if you'd not acted as you did. So one example is that's relevant to nonprofits, I think, is if you're fundraising. So suppose you raise $1 million in a fundraising campaign. You might think, oh, the amount of good I do is just the value of that $1 million from my charity. But you've got to think about what would have happened otherwise. How much of that money would have been donated to some other charity, even if you'd not run that fundraising campaign? And if it were the case that it would all have just been donated to some other charity, and that charity was just as effective as you, then actually this fundraising campaign had no impact at all. And there's some arguments for thinking that that is often the case. Overall, charitable giving remains at just 2% in the U.S., and it stayed pretty fixed at that for quite some time. It certainly, I think, will decrease the effectiveness of many fundraising campaigns. Partly, you're just taking money away from other charities.
All right, let's take that break, and when we come back, Will and I will continue talking about the theory of effective altruism and its lessons for your nonprofit. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag NonprofitRadio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, "Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office." Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
If you have big ideas but an average budget, tune into Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio for ideas you can use. I do. I'm Dr. Robert Penna, author of the Nonprofit Outcomes Toolbox.
Very interesting that that drop was by Dr. Robert Penna, who's been a guest on the show. I'm not going to give you a chance to explain, but I'll direct people to the book because we want people to buy this book for a lot of reasons. But one of them is Will has a commentary on something that Ken Berger, who's also been on the guest, been a guest multiple times, actually, former CEO of Cherry Navigator. He's been on many times. Bob Penner was on once, I think just once. And Will has some commentary on an article that Berger and Penner wrote. And Will, I hope you're going to forgive me. I got to leave it there because we don't have time to go into it, but it'll increase demand for your book.
Okay, I'm
okay.
Glad.
Okay, yeah, sorry. Did you notice that? That I did not choose that drop. Our producer chooses the drop, so I did not put that in to be provocative to you. So please don't think that.
No, it is at all.
Okay, that's purely a coincidence. All right, so our fourth question, you know, what would happen otherwise? So where's a lesson that we can draw here for nonprofits before we move on to the fifth question?
Yeah, so one, like I said, was thinking about, you know, if you're running a fundraising campaign, how much of the money would have been donated otherwise, and if you can, trying to track that. Another is in terms of the impact and how you're measuring the impact you're having. So an example I give is of the Scared Straight program, a very popular social program in the U.S., where juvenile delinquents get taken to prison for a few hours to scare them out of a life of crime. And on its face, it might look like an effective program because the juveniles go on to commit fewer crimes than they had been committing in the past. So you might think, oh, therefore the program was effective. But that's not thinking about what would have happened otherwise. And in fact, when the program's been tested, it seems to increase rates of criminality. So if those juvenile delinquents hadn't been taken on the Scared Straight program, they would have gone on to commit even fewer crimes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's obviously crucial because it's a program that's actively doing harm for society. In fact, one estimate suggested that for every dollar invested in the program, society bore the cost of $230 as a result of increased criminality.
Startling. Yeah. And Scared Straight has been the subject of cable TV shows and lots of popular press. And yeah, remarkable.
Yeah.
All right. Due to time, you know, we have to we got to move to our fifth question. What are the chances of success and how good would it be?
Great. And this is a way to compare kind of very concrete ways of doing good, like I was talking about distributing bed nets or deworming children, with things that are more uncertain, like lobbying for political change or trying to create a societal norm shift. And you might think, oh, it's just impossible to make these comparisons. It's unquantifiable. But I think that's too hasty. And so I think that you can make progress on this by using the idea of expected value, which is this idea of looking at the probability of success and looking at just how good would success be. And then you multiply those two together, and that's the expected value. So if you've got a 1 in 100 chance of saving 100 lives, that's meant to at least be as good as, you know, a guarantee of saving one life.
Right. 0.01 times 100.
That's right. A 1 in 100 chance of saving 100 people is as good as a guarantee of saving one.
Saving one, right.
And through this, I think you can start to at least get rough comparisons of how good certain sorts of systemic change operations are. I give one example again on a personal level of someone deciding whether to earn to give or deciding whether to go into politics. And with her, we look at what are the odds of her successfully becoming an MP or in the cabinet. So this was in the UK. And then secondly, try and look at, like, well, if she were that successful, just how much of an impact would she be having? And using this, we got the conclusion that it was likely that she'd be able to do an awful lot more good by becoming a politician than by just trying to earn to give and donating to these kind of concrete, measurable charities. And so I think there's, like, power there to have a more rigorous, reflective way of thinking about, you know, systemic or lower probability but higher upside change versus more concrete, measurable ways of doing good.
Right. So to not fear that which has a low probability but which has an enormous payoff.
Exactly.
Was smallpox eradication, was that, well, actually, no, you make a point that there was already some political will behind that. So that wasn't deemed to be a very small probability of success at its outset, was it?
I think it probably was still.
Oh, was still?
So no disease had ever been eradicated before.
And so
it still, I think, would have seemed like a long shot. And so it's pretty remarkable they did manage to achieve it. But even supposing it had just been, they thought, okay, this was only a 10% chance of this working, or 5% chance. Given the size of how good the outcome would be, it would have clearly still been very worth doing.
Yes. And so I think a lesson for nonprofits is to not fear those low probability but very high payoff programs and work.
That's right. Being effective does not necessarily mean only doing things where you can quantify in a short time period the impact you're having.
Yeah. And of course, which leads directly into the second half of your book, which we don't have time to do. We need another hour for that. But the concern about too much distraction and overemphasis on CEO pay and proportion of revenue that goes to overhead and administrative costs. Those things are I think you call them distractions.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. When you're thinking about giving to a charity, you know, it's just in the same way as if you were buying a laptop. You don't care how much Tim Cook is paid as a CEO. You don't care how much Apple spends on its administration costs. You just care about the quality of the product and how much that product costs. And I think we should apply the same to the case of charities.
Brilliant. We have to leave it there. Will, thank you so much. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. The book is Doing Good Better, How Effective Altruism Can Help You Make a Difference. If you want to follow Will on Twitter, he's at Will McCaskill. Next week, you're bored as brand ambassadors. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled. And by We Be Spelling, super cool spelling bee fundraisers, WeBeeSpelling.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Liebowitz is the line producer. Betty McCardle is our new AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. And our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people. Because otherwise, a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yes. It was like, it was phone. This email thing is weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperstein.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.